It's the music show that you're listening to. It's time to talk to Phil Slater, trumpeter, composer. He's got a new double album out. It's called The Dark Pattern. Phil Slater lives just north of Wollongong, Mount Ouseley, up on the Illawarra Escarpment there on the New South Wales coast. And this is significant because he made a daily practice of taking his trumpet up the mountain and playing in the landscape. And the result is this new album. We'll talk to Phil in a moment. Let's have a listen to the album first. Well, those are the opening moments of the album The Dark Pattern by Phil Slater. Phil Slater's trumpet, Matt McMahon's piano, and we're just hearing Brett Hurst on bass, Simon Barker on cymbals there, and Matt Keegan is about to join in on saxophone. It's a double album, as I said. It goes for 2 hours, and it's extremely intense music, as you can hear. It doesn't let up. And it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the music show, Phil Slater. You're not looking intense at all.
How are you, Andy?
I'm very well, thank you. This is an amazing album, Phil. And I wonder when you embarked on it, if you had a sound in mind.
I guess the easy answer is no, but what I was interested in is contrast and in textures of sounds. So potentially, I knew what the ingredients were, but I wasn't quite aware of what the outcome would be.
You knew who you wanted to work with?
Yeah, I'm...
I know these are old friends, of course.
Yeah, they're old friends, and that's important. And collaboratively, we come up with things that I think are far greater than our sort of component parts. So I'm used to playing with these people, and I like what they bring out of me, and I like to think that I can bring something out of them with my playing.
Yes. And what did you give them at the beginning of this process? I mean, when you went into the studio with them, we were talking not long ago on the show, just a few weeks ago, to Paul Grabowski about Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. And on that occasion, Miles Davis gave his players very little to go on. And certainly they hadn't rehearsed. And I wonder whether you had a similar approach.
Well, we did rehearse, but I guess the way to think about it is that the music is... I try to give as little as possible. I find that there is this sweet spot of giving too much information where you're sort of preempting the performance as opposed to letting it emerge. So... I really do try to think of it as a sort of generative process, and the compositions are generative in that they offer constraints to the players more than directions.
We'll come back to the constraints in a moment, but let's talk about the fact that this is your first album for a while, and you've been off doing a PhD. Maybe you could tell us briefly what that's about.
The research project is sort of looking at a few different areas of music making, but I guess the initial sort of impetus for the research is trying to understand this idea of landscape in Australian music, and potentially offering a performer perspective as opposed to a composer's perspective or a musicologist's perspective. Because I think that once this perspective is offered, it sort of opens up landscape in new ways, new ways of thinking about it, new ways of sort of exploring that as a theme in music making. And it is a common theme in Australia. And as someone who sort of started my studies in the early 90s in Australia, I mean, it was the topic everywhere was trying to find an Australian aesthetic, and that the landscape was the obvious place to start looking. And so I've been thinking about that for a long time, and quite frankly, sort of being confused by it all.
And you've been working on, of course, with Music of Sculthorpe, which is a sort of the obvious musical place to go, isn't it, if you're going to talk about music and landscape in Australia?
Well, I studied with Peter at Sydney Uni, and I studied with you, and we talked about this all the time, about this problem of authenticity and trying to come, like, what is Australian music? I mean, is it even worthwhile thinking about this? And I'm still confused by it all. But what was interesting to me was this emphasis upon the representation of the landscape in music. And I guess what I was interested in exploring in this sort of in this research project was, can we think of the landscape in non-representational ways? Can it in fact sort of offer opportunities for a performer to develop skills and to learn about music making in a more sort of real-time interactive way?
Mm. You entered the landscape very consciously, didn't you? I mean, we talk about Peter Sculthorpe's music. I mean, Peter was not an outdoors person, and his approach to landscape more or less was symbolic. It was about what the landscape represented, I think, and maybe of the way it's represented in art. I mean, he looked at Taz Drysdale's paintings, found his way into the landscape that way, but you walked into it. You stepped into the landscape with your instrument. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm particularly interested in ideas around embodied knowledge and embodied theories of mind, and this sort of emerging theory of mind work where we're trying to understand how we think in terms of where we are and what we're made up of. That our brains have evolved in bodies like ours actually accounts for a lot of the thinking that we do. So in a broad sense, it's moving away from this idea that the brain is sort of organizing the body to act in the world. And then in fact, the world might actually be making a lot of the decisions for the body, that we're in fact always embedded and enacting the environments that we're in. And so I'm interested in pursuing that within a musical context. I guess an interesting analogy would be, you know, the skills that we develop, the learning that we get from walking up a hill as opposed to just looking at it and thinking about it and perhaps drawing it or writing about it. Mm. So it's a real embodiment of place, this idea that the body can actually kind of indexically kind of represent the landscape as opposed to a sort of pictorial modality.
And when you're there in the landscape blowing your trumpet, you're obviously drawing on the air for a start, which is presumably cleaner than it would be in a practice room, in terms of a small example.
Well, you're actually pretty right about this. I mean, I had to come up with a working definition of what landscape is, because it means so many things to so many different people. And so if I kind of reduce the landscape down to a collection of surfaces, objects and events, then I'm able to then go about interacting with those three things in lots of different ways and over lots of different sort of time frames. So there's the immediate decisions of the performance that you're in the middle of doing. But over a series of weeks or months, those sort of accumulate into understandings and learnings about what it is that you like to do, what it is that you can do, and how those things can sort of coalesce within you in a musical way.
And did you get feedback? I mean, I'm talking about from the landscape, from the sounds in the landscape. Did the birds join in?
One of the interesting things that I developed was this ability or confidence or an interest in sounds that weren't reacting with me. And so often in a jazz context or in a musical context, things become, just because of the nature of interaction, things become a bit rhetorical, where you're playing things to elicit a certain reaction out of certain players and vice versa. What became interesting to me the more I undertook this practice project was how, I guess, self-sufficient or non-rhetorical my playing was becoming, that I wasn't playing to shape a performance trajectory, or it was a kind of comfort in just letting things be musically, melodically, rhythmically. This idea that things don't always need to be so hyper-reactive, and there is an actual sort of beauty that can come through just things sort of meandering, you know, under their own steam.
So does it come down to listening then?
It's listening and it's acting. It's the combination of the perception and the action. It's that they both become the same thing.
You're listening to The Music Show at the moment on RN. My guest is trumpeter-composer Phil Slater, and we're talking about his new album, The Dark Pattern. It's full of pulses, what Mac McMahon is doing on that track, tapping away at the keyboard, that goes on pretty much throughout the entire two discs, doesn't it? Someone somewhere is tapping away. It might be Simon Barker on a cymbal or something like that. What are the pulses about?
The pulses are about lots of things, but on a sort of pragmatic level, they are a way for me to not play the pulses. Not be so explicit in being sort of tempo bound or prescriptively rhythmical, if that makes sense. So the pulses are a constraint that sort of take away options for the players.
And is this, I mean, because you talk a lot about constraints, and in the context of what you were saying earlier about Australian artists and the landscape, we're being quite conscious, even self-conscious, in having that conversation. And is this a way to strip away self-consciousness, these constraints, because they force you, in a sense, to think less and listen more? Maybe just think less and act more.
Thinking is acting. So it's the same process as what I'm sort of interested in. I think in terms of like the topic of the landscape, I'm interested in it being more ordinary than extraordinary. I want it to be, I practiced in ordinary places that were near where I live. It became less about it being this sort of extravagant or epic or sort of overly beautiful. Just notions of that were removed. It was just ordinary place, and I was just doing ordinary playing. And something sort of emerged from treating it in a kind of modest way like that.
Yes. And what about the instrument itself? Do you feel differently about your trumpet, having had that intense experience of A, not performing, recording, and B, taking the trumpet every day out into the landscape?
I think what happened was this sort of stripping away of technical things that I was consumed with. And there was a more, this sort of acceptance sort of emerged out of it. Also, part of the project is coping with the challenges of performing in some of the places I played in. So there are certain things that I had to develop or sort of invent or sort of accept, that certain things work better, certain sort of tonguing patterns or sort of articulation sort of groupings and things just worked better. It coped better under that sort of environmental constraint. And so it's a kind of I think acceptance is the best word. Just allowing things to happen and accepting where they are and not trying to, from a technical point of view, not trying to correct things. And that's a very difficult thing to do, but I think it's something that is maybe counterintuitive to the way that most music is taught, that we're trying to achieve a kind of perfect, pre-established idea of what the sound is that we're trying to make. So I guess my process is more about accepting the sound that I'm making, but in doing so, that sort of allows things to happen.
So is the trumpet, in a way, almost incidental to what you do? Is it simply the instrument that you think through or speak through or act through? I mean, could it be another instrument and the music would be more or less the same?
Well, no, the music would be different. You could do it on other instruments, but the point of the constraints-led approach that I'm quite interested in sort of exploring is that every experience is the experience of an individual. And that individual for me means the trumpet. But if I was on a push bike or if I was walking or if I had another sort of tool in my hand, the landscape offers different possibilities. So it's all about the possibilities that are afforded the individual. And those possibilities changed given the kind of skill set that you have, but also the sort of implements that are around you.
So is there any going back now? Or do you feel as though you've sort of broken through some sort of wall and you have to keep going in that direction?
I don't have to go in that direction, but one of the things that this really kind of revealed to me, that change is inevitable and change is happening all the time, and that we're, as bodies, we're adapting to the environment all the time. And so change is inevitable. I will change, my playing will change. And this is, in a sense, an important sort of snapshot of a developmental period of a performer.
And what I like about it as a listener, one of the things I like about it as a listener, is the fact that it gives itself up very slowly, that you have to be patient with this music. There's no point in listening to it, as I'm afraid we have done, just in a small grab. You actually have to let it take over. And it suggests that we need to find time for ourselves and for our experiences that the modern world doesn't afford us very much of.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the intentions of the music is for it to have a kind of intention where there are no real high points or low points. It is a constant. I want it to have that environmental sense of just never ending. And I'd like that the music to have that sense of it could start anywhere, it could finish anywhere. It's a kind of big cycle.
Phil Slater, thank you very much for talking to me on The Music Show.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back.
Music by Phil Slater from The Dark Pattern. It's out on Earshift Music.